blue card to the right side of your seat. You'll chant the opening sutra.
She's the foremost senior student of the late Koba Chino Tagawa.
Well, I'm honored to be here. This is, it was such a surprise. I followed this enterprise for a long time.
Oh, really?
Just hearing about it and being on the mailing list and knowing what y'all are doing and sort of cheering you on from my corner, knowing what it's like, because creating a place like this is such an amazing and gnarly project. It takes a lot of chutzpah to not only think about doing such a thing, but actually bring it into pass on the ground itself is almost amazing. And that it's happening here, it's happening at Jikoji, it's happening in many, many places all over America. I tend to prefer these rustic ways. In our Sangha, we inherited enough money that we could create a Sangha meeting place where we could have all the Zafus and Zabutons there already. We didn't have to carry them around. And some people wanted a city place and others wanted a country place. And so we split and we created two places. And our place was the country place, the one that I was helping to create. We inherited a whole lot of disaffected hippies when we created Jikoji. So it was an extremely challenging time, and also a wonderful time for Coben to bring his teaching down to the ground, to the real place where we were. One place we learned it was when we were putting together the all the papers for the county and the state, trying to explain ourselves. And we asked Coben, what about membership? Are we going to have members? And Coben looked at us and he said, all members, all beings are members of our Sangha. All beings. So we put that down on our use permit. All beings are members of our Sangha. And for me, that was the greatest thing. There was no separation. So anybody was welcome. And Coben invited all the disaffected hippies to come and sit with us. And some did. Some were difficult. Some of them played loud music when we were sitting. Or walked by the zendo and made loud, rude noises. But it was, again, the same teaching. We accepted these people. They were there first. They kept telling us that only God owned the land, so they had every right to be there. And there was a little logic to that, so we tried to work with them. It got very difficult, and we got into financial difficulties, and we thought we had to sell it. So eventually we had to escort people out. But again, we did it in a way that we found places for them to go. We didn't just kick them out, which is what the city folks thought we should do. It was a different state of mind. And I learned so much from that, that even these guys, and some of them were drug-crazed, and some of them bragged about having been in prison for so long. And if you got underneath all that talk, you found somebody. There was always somebody there. And in this case, we had to work with them, and we did. It was a wonderful teaching, a very humbling teaching. We couldn't explain it to anybody else. They just thought we were totally nuts to be up there. And it took a long time for it to become cohesive enough to make sense to people, to actually be a safe place to come. And then I began to realize that, of course, that's what we are creating, is a safe place for people to come and do this remarkable thing, this zazen thing. One of my students asked me the other day, she's becoming a teacher now, and she asked me, what was the most important thing to teach? And right away I said, zazen. I mean, there's Dogen Zenji, there's Keizan Zenji, there's masses and masses. You have a beautiful library here of all the words that have been expressed around this untalkaboutable teaching. You really can't say it. And yet, there is a need to reflect and connect about it. It's why sitting together in this way as Sangha is so important. We, of course, sit, I hope we sit every day. and we sit as we can at lunch hour, at work, or in the evening when everything is done. But to come together like this is the most precious thing that we have. And to have a place in which we can come together in this way is, it's your treasure. It's our treasure. I represent floating Zendo because we don't have a place. We're an offshoot of Jikoji. Finally, I left Jikoji and I said, I'll sit with anybody, but don't ask me to organize anything. So I began to sit all by myself, and eventually one or two people showed up, and then they started to organize things. And before we knew it, we had a sangha. And they found a place for us to sit at the Quaker meeting house, which is a little wooden church-like building with straight back chairs that we pile up at the end and just clear up and sit. So it's we don't own it. We don't have to take care of it except to put the chairs back when we're done. And it's such a generous space that we don't mind the floating aspect of our life. But we support Jikoji at the same time as you all support this place, because it's so precious, and have our retreats up there. Koban was a remarkable teacher, and many people did not understand him. many people were annoyed. They would come to his talks and they'd come out saying, I didn't understand one word he said. It was very often that way. And yet, what he was expressing was in a very unusual way, in a way that was accessible to some of us, in a way that nothing else ever had been. And his way with us was so subtle and so interesting. There was one time when I was full of anxiety about one of my children, and I had to talk to Koban. And I thought, I need a Dokusan. So we made a date for me to meet in his office, and I rushed over there, and I was all ready to talk my talk. And he said, let's go to the park. I thought, oh, I don't want to go to the park. But of course, I went to the park with him, and we sat down, and I thought, okay, I guess I can tell my story now. And a big dog came up. And Koban had a bag of cookies that he was about to offer me. And the big dog started nosing the bag of cookies. And I started pushing the dog away. Go away, dog. And Koban reached into the bag and pulled out a couple of cookies and gave them to the dog. And the dog went away. And all of a sudden, I didn't have any questions at all. They were gone. And I was so ashamed. I thought, oh my goodness, this dog needed something and we could give him something. Why not? But so often we don't. He was that kind of person. He was enormously generous way over generous, really. I was in a car with him once, and he picked up a hitchhiker, and the hitchhiker said he didn't have any money, so Coben just emptied his pockets, just gave him everything he had. I said, "Don't do that, Coben, don't do that." But he had to do that. So he took over from Suzuki Roshi at Haiku Zendo, which was a tiny little garage in Los Altos, which was in the Bay Area when the Bay Area was full of apricot trees and cherry trees and few, not so many houses. That little Zendo had the flavor of Suzuki Roshi because he created it, and his students were the ones who started it. They were a bunch of little old ladies, especially really marvelous old ladies who had participated in the veteran administration's experiments with LSD before LSD was put on hold. And so they were a very lively group. And then there were Stanford students and us so-called housewives. And it was a motley group, but we were all poets. So we had poetry readings, and we had music, and lots and lots and lots of sitting. We had 5 sessions, week-long sessions a year. It was a very rich time. And then Coben said, we should have a place bigger than this. This is not big enough. So we started trying to find a place, and that's how Jikoji came to be. And then we said, what shall we call ourselves? And Coben said, well, we should call it Bodhi. He said, Bodhi, what's that? He said, well, it means enlightenment. Oh, that was a big burden. We felt it was too heavy. But Bodhi was the beginning of it all. And then Jikoji came out of that as Compassion Light Temple. And then he went to New Mexico and created Hokoji, which was a Wisdom Light Temple. So together we are sort of brother-sister of practice. And we do practice together as much as we can, coming back and forth between. So there are many, many Coben stories, how he practiced and how he disappointed people. He was very tricky and would not indulge anybody, not for a minute. If he made an appointment with somebody who was over anxious, he wouldn't show up. And there were several who felt that that he owed them, that they were more important, and that he should be there. And those people, he just wasn't. He just wouldn't show up. That was a way to learn something also. He looked like a very kindly, gentle, soft-spoken person, but underneath he was a little bit, it hurt a little bit, in a good way, in a necessary way. I was truly a housewife, though I refused to call myself that. I was just the era when no woman wanted to be that anymore. And so we were all extremely independent and rebellious. And when it was time for me to leave Jikoji, they had a little ceremony in the Zendo, and they gave me a beautiful scroll and some very kind words. And then Coben said, in his sort of dreamlike voice, "I never knew that there would be a transmitted housewife, except for my mother, until I met you," he said. And I was so incensed. I thought, "No, I'm not a housewife." I missed the whole message, really. It was so tricky. So there are many stories, and maybe you all have questions about this this practice. We call it a practice because it's a thing we enact. It's not like practicing the piano or the violin. It's an enactment of wisdom, enactment of our own ability and insight and beauty and the best of us. So you may have questions about practice or about Chikoji. Yes.
If you could say a bit about what you thought you were getting from the student-teacher relationship at the time and how your perspective on that changed.
Which time?
Oh, at the time that you were with Coben, and then over the years since, how has your perspective on that changed?
Oh, good idea. Yes, very good question. I began as a very shy person. I just hid in the Zendo. I didn't want to talk to anybody. I was very shy. And only went there because somebody at Tassajara, when we were guests at Tassajara, just sent me there. So for a long time, I didn't talk to him. But there was a Monday morning group with the old ladies, and I went to the Monday morning group, and that began a relationship. And then I started to record and transcribe his talks. And so that became another kind of relationship. So slowly, slowly, it became a student-teacher thing. But then with Chikoji, Coben's wife left him in the middle of the whole business. And he was devastated. So he went away to New Mexico and left us with the thing sort of half-made. And we had to decide what to do. And I was so determined. I just thought, we have to do this. We have to have a place for Coben's teaching because it's so remarkable. And so we just hung in there and did what we could. And when it was time for Sesshin, we had Sesshin. And little by little, I started to teach, quote unquote. I started to say something because nobody else would. And little by little, it became a kind of practice for me to say things in the Zendo. And of course, Coben would come back, and then I'd be so glad. Oh, heavens! And then he would give us a real sesshin, so-called. But I learned so much that way. And he, in his inimitable way, presented me with a teaching stick at a memorial service for somebody's father who had just died. He had it on the altar, and he called me up and asked me to help him at the service. And there was the teaching stick, and he just gave it to me and sent me back to my seat. And I thought, what does this mean? And then, very soon after that, actually, I came down with cancer. And it was a shock. It was to him. He burst into tears when I told him. But then he told me, first he said, well, you know, everybody has to die, which was the best thing anybody could have said. It was a huge relief. I thought, thank you, Coben, thank you. That after that, he sent me to Green Gulch to make this. He said, talk to Blanche Hartman, and she will help you. So I called Blanche, and she said, well, what color does he want? And I said, I don't know. I don't know anything about this. I don't even know what an Ocasa is. He said, so I asked Coben, and he said, oh, a kind of earth color, some kind of earth color. And first I thought of Georgia O'Keeffe, and I thought, oh, oranges and blues and yellows. And I thought, no, no, Annabelle, you can't do that. So I just went and got the cheapest brown fabric I could find and took it up to Green Gulch and put it on the table in front of everybody. And they looked at me like, you must be kidding. You must be kidding. No way. A brown? You want brown? And I said, Coben wanted it. He wanted it. So I made it in a week. I thought I was dying. This was 30 years ago, so not to worry. And there was a man there who was dying of AIDS. So the two of us were sewing up a storm because we thought we'd better get it done in time. And it was a wonderful experience, truly wonderful. And then I gave it to him, of course, and didn't see it for a long, 4 years, I think. 4 years. And we kept on having sesshin, and one sesshin, Blanche wanted to come. And so she sat with us the whole week. And believe it or not, somebody's grandmother died and came and asked Coben to do a memorial service. And Coben called me up to the altar when he was doing the memorial service for the grandmother. And he had the Ocasa. And he put it on my head. And we did the Daizai 3 times. And they dressed me, he and Blanche. And then we walked out the door together, and Coben said, you know, it's not yours. He said, if somebody comes from Japan and they've forgotten theirs, you can let them wear it. So I didn't wear it for a couple of years. It scared me to death. I thought, I don't know what this thing is. But then Blanche insisted that I go with her to Japan, to Rinso Inn, to Suzuki Roshi's temple, with 11 other women from the Bay Area, and practice for a month. And so we did that. And I had all the time with Coben been in confusion, because Coben hardly told us how to do things. We watched him and tried to learn. But when I asked him about how to do a wedding, he said, make it up. Just make it up. So it was not very helpful. And I thought, if I go to Japan, I will learn how to do everything the right way. And it's my favorite story, really. There was young Suzuki Roshi, Suzuki Roshi's son, and there was Blanche, and there was a monk from Sojiji who was there to sort of buck up Roshi, who was sort of appalled by all these women crowding in his place. And they all gathered at the altar, to teach us. The first lesson was going to be how to sound the bell, the big bell. And so one of them took it and did it one way. And one of them said, no, wait, we don't do it that way. And they said, look, we do it this way. And the other said, no, we do it a totally different way. And all three of them disagreed about how to do the bell. And I was sitting there going, hooray, they're making it up. They've all made it up. It's all arbitrary. And it was a wonderful lesson about the forms itself, that the forms are not cast in bronze. They're not coming down from heaven. They're coming from inside of us. And they're our way of practice, the way that we find to maintain our balance and our knowledge and our insight. As we go, it's very special, particular way to be in the world, to mind the forms without getting caught by them. It's very easy to get caught by them. In fact, Blanche was caught by them. There was a while when she just got so into it and wanted everything to be exactly the same way. It doesn't have to be precisely the same way, because it can't be. But it can be your way. When I tried to learn how to serve the altar in a service, I would watch Coben very carefully. And he would do it differently at different times. Just when I'd think I knew how, he did it a different way. And again, I thought, okay, I can just do it my own way. And that is a way. Each one of us is a way. And the form gives us an avenue to that way. So it's very precious. And then Coben died. Blanche called me up and said, Coben's dead. And he just flew right into me like that. Boom, like that. And I became a different kind of teacher then. I don't know how to say what that was, but it was different. And it's continuing. And I'm old now. I'm not used to being old yet. I'm very grumpy about it. You think you get used to it, but it's so inconvenient. But I have lots of help, and so I'm hanging in there as long as I can, and needing more help and receiving it. I'm so shy and so. So grateful that it's a whole new lesson to me, really, this oldness that is happening. So thank you. That's a wonderful question. Anything else? Yes.
I sometimes ask myself if there's something like the right speed of getting to know your true self, or of getting rid of your conditioning. I've lived here for 1 year now, and that was extremely beneficial, but a big part of me wants to go out there again in the world, and I'm 34, and people my age, they work on their careers, they work on their standing in the world, and they work on being somebody, and on financial security, and I find that so difficult to decide how much Zen, how much meditation, how much practice, mm-hmm. what's right. Can you go even too fast, like abandoning everything that you found pleasure? Can you overdo it, like abandoning too much at the same time?
St. Bridget gave away everything she owned, and then she started giving away her father's shoes. And he stopped her and he said, "Bridget, this is too much. You know, you can give away too much." So, yes. But it really depends. There are so many. Our little group of Floating Zendo is a fairly small group, and most of them are working, and working in Silicon Valley, or have just retired and are kind of recovering from the strain of it. So I know what you mean. It's a very intense life if you're out there. And so my view is you need Zazen even more. But maybe not a monastic practice. If you have a daily practice and a sangha to practice with, you can have a life as well. There's no difference between you here and you out there. It's still the same. And your real self, you'll never know. You don't know who you are. Really, you just enact yourself as things arise. You become you as your life comes to you. So you don't need to worry about yourself so much. You can just find your best way, the way that feels the best to you. And it's the most useful to other people because you're not alone. You're connected to all of us, and so we're all supporting you, and we'll support you whatever happens to you. So you can always remember that. And then just, sometimes the Quakers say, proceed as way opens. So if you don't know, just sit with it until you do. It'll come to you. Yes.
What did Coben do for fun?
Everything. Right? He was a naughty boy. He loved to drink. He loved to play. He loved to hang out. He loved to ride horses. He was obsessed with horses. When he moved out to Shambhala, he had to take his horses with him and drive them all the way across the country. He was fun to be with. In New Mexico, when he was building a house for himself, he had hired builders, a bunch of young folks, and every night he would take them out to dinner at the best restaurant in Taos. He ran out of money before he finished building the house. But they had a blast. They just had a great time. Yeah, and yet when he walked into the Zendo, he was a different person. So his wife always said he shouldn't have been a priest. He should have just been an artist and a poet, because that's what he really was. And he just got stuck. He said he was pickled in Zen because he was born in a temple. And they shaved his head when he was 12 and gave him agony in school as a result. He had a real hard time. So anytime he had a chance to have fun, he took it. Zen looks very serious. I mean, Zen is very serious. It's a life and death practice, really. And, of course, we walk around with these faces. If you look at all the photographs, they're all like that. And I think, yes, but there's joy in this practice as well. And really, if you look at most statues of Buddha, there's a smile, almost always. And if you smile, it changes the whole aspect of your brain measurably. It lifts your mind. So next time you feel blue, remember that. Teach yourself to smile.
Up and brush up our mat. Thank you.
So there's just a few short announcements. Next week on Saturday, we have a special program. It's our Work Fest. This is a chance for us to come together and do something a little different here at the Zen Center instead of sitting and having our regular program. What we're going to do is do some work around the for the land. Now, we have our second phase of the building project that's coming up, which is going to be starting actually next week, and we need to get ready for that. We're going to be putting in a fence for the construction, the silt fence, and also some tree protection signs to help the graders as they go through the land. It's a great day to come out and help out the Zen Center and actually kind of come together in this together action in a different way. The week after, we have a children's program coming up. I believe that Friday night there's a children's camp out and sleepover. And then during the day, the next day, it's a chance for people to bring up their kids, and they have special fun projects and games for them to do here at the Zen Center. Well, hopefully while their parents are sitting. We do also ask for a $10 donation to help keep our programs going here at the Zen Center. We do have a lunch, which is going to be served in just a few minutes. The Zen Dust store is open, which is on the northeast side of the Sangha House, so up in this corner. And you can see what we have there for Zen Dust items. We need maybe three volunteers to help Angus set up the Zendo again. So, Tim, anyone else? Peter? So we start from the back rows and come out first. We come back around the altar here, and then we leave by twos